loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, the Iranian government yesterday informed the United Nations nuclear watchdog that it planned to begin the process of increasing its capacity to enrich uranium. The Iranian decision was taken in light of the U.S. withdrawal from the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or Iran, nuclear deal. Next, President Trump yesterday disinvited the entire Philadelphia Eagles football team from a White House event celebrating their Super Bowl victory because a handful of players were not planning to attend. The president was offended that individual players were boycotting the event, and he released a statement criticizing them and alluding to the controversy over kneeling during the national anthem. Then the Pentagon is increasing spending on a secret research effort to use artificial intelligence to help anticipate the launch of a nuclear-capable missile, as well as to track and target mobile missile launchers. If the effort is successful, such computer programs will be able to think for themselves. And then prosecutors representing Special Counsel Robert Mueller yesterday accused former Trump campaign manager Paul Manafort of jury tampering. They say that Manafort has attempted to influence the testimony of two witnesses in his upcoming criminal trial, and they're asking a judge to revoke his bail and send him to jail. And finally, the Supreme Court, by a 7-2 vote, ruled yesterday that a Colorado cake shop owner did not have to make a wedding cake for a same-sex couple. The ruling was narrowly written and specific only to this case, but experts believe that it will encourage other people to file anti-civil rights cases based on religious freedom arguments. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. But first, we turn to Iran. The Iranian government yesterday informed the United Nations nuclear watchdog that it planned to begin the process of increasing its capacity to enrich uranium. The Iranian decision was taken in light of the U.S. withdrawal from the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or Iran nuclear deal. We're joined from Tehran by Dr. Mohammad Mirandi. He's an expert on American studies and postcolonial literature who teaches at the University of Tehran. Welcome back, Mohammad.
Thank you for having me.
Mohammad, what does this mean for the larger international group that's working to salvage what's left of the JCPOA?
Well, basically, what's happening is that the Iranians, after the United States pulled out, they agreed to wait to see if the European Union is prepared to make commitments to that would effectively save the agreement. And the Iranians have been saying that verbal commitments are not enough, they're useless, and that the EU has to give explicit commitments that will ensure that European businesses and citizens are protected from the U.S. government. Up to now, the Iranians feel that the Europeans are buying time and that they are not willing to commit themselves to preserving the JCPOA in an effective manner. So what the leader said yesterday, Ayatollah Khamenei, is that we are preparing the grounds to restart our peaceful nuclear program, those elements that have been shut down. Basically what he's saying is that if the Europeans don't make a clear decision to preserve the JCPOA in a meaningful fashion, then Iran has no option but to go back to restarting its nuclear program in full.
And what do you think the Europeans will do? And I know this is just speculation, but here in the United States, there really is a debate going on over whether the Europeans ought to just ignore the Trump administration and continue relations, trade relations with Iran, and not just the Europeans, but the Russians, the Chinese, the Japanese, and others, rather than to fall in line, because these trade relationships now have been established and they're working, and they brought Iran into the international community, so to speak. That this is a mistake of American policy. It's a mistake of this president. What are people saying in Tehran?
Well, there's a big difference between Russia and China and the EU, because the Russians and the Chinese have many businesses that have no dealings with the United States, and they can use the Chinese or Russian currencies. The EU is willing to use the euro, but the problem is that many of the European companies are unwilling to continue trade with Iran without protection because they have shareholders in the United States or they use the US dollar and they can be punished by the American government. So despite the fact that these European companies are abiding by international law, they are doing legitimate business, but they can be fined or destroyed by the US government simply because they're not abiding by US laws. And unless the European Union is willing to grow a backbone, unless it's willing to protect its citizens from a third party, then the Iranians are saying the agreement is meaningless because it's fine for the Europeans to say that, yes, you're allowed to do business with Iran, but if no one is prepared to do business, if everyone is too afraid to do business, then they might as well just be sanctioned.
Right. And that's the debate that's happening here in the United States as well.
Yeah. So Mohammed, what's going on inside of Iran, inside the body politics, say, of Iran as a consequence of all that's happened in the last couple months?
Well, basically, what has happened, in my opinion, is that those who believe that Iran should do a deal with the United States have either been completely discredited or they themselves have shifted their position. And the United States now is, according to polls, is itself very unpopular in Iran. Before, in polling that used to be carried out in Iran, the U.S. government used to get unfavorable ratings, but the United States got more positive ratings. Now, the U.S. government has literally zero support in Iran. It's almost universally despised under Trump. And the United States itself has become unpopular. So it's not zero like Trump's ratings, but the United States' soft power in Iran has been utterly demolished. And I think that's one of the things that Trump or Trump supporters don't recognize, that the United States is less popular than before, and the U.S. government is universally hated almost among Iranians. And I don't think that is something that strengthens the U.S. position anywhere.
You know, it's funny, John, listening to Mohammed Mirandi talk about how this has impacted on how the people think about not just Trump, but as a consequence of the United States. We had that discussion yesterday with people talking about what's going on in China with all of the sanctions on China that seem to be part of a gratuitous attack. And our guest was telling us, you know, at the end of World War II, and even in the first days of the or years or decades of the People's Republic of China, there was still sort of a nostalgic looking back at the good United States because the United States was on the side of China against Japan during World War II. But how that sort of residue of public support for America, maybe not America's policies, but America has just been eviscerated as a consequence of Trump's policies. You know, it makes you wonder, Mohammed, here the U.S. is the preeminent power in the world, but how the world thinks about the United States actually long term will matter.
My understanding, at least in Iran, is that the U.S. president is more widely despised in Iran than was George Bush after the invasion of Iraq. And the United States itself, its image is worse than it was under Bush. I have to look at the numbers with regards to the presidency. I'm sure about it. With regards to the United States itself, I'm almost 100% sure that that's true. So what Trump has done in less than 2 years is that he's created a situation that even George W. Bush was not able to create in a negative way after 8 years.
Yeah, and that's a high bar. So again, in terms of, you know, in American popular vernacular, there's the moderates and the hardliners. That's how Iran's political sort of tendencies or factions are described. Of course, it's completely, I don't know, it's like America. You know, it's based on profound ignorance and stereotyping and caricatures and using the wrong words to describe things because it's just, in a way, propaganda. But there are the principalists and their opponents within the larger politics of Iran. What you're suggesting is that Rouhani, his foreign minister, that grouping that invested so much capital and time and energy to make this agreement, that their position is either diminished inside of Iran or their position is no longer their position because it's not tenable.
President Rouhani right now has been making statements over the last few weeks that if you translate them into English, they would be considered to be the positions that hardliners take. And the reason is obvious, that President Rouhani has given the United States every opportunity to change its behavior, to bring about rapprochement. And the United States basically slapped him in the face and spit on him in the face. And so he's changed his stance, and the rest of the Iranian political spectrum is changing as well. I don't know of any serious person right now who thinks that the United States government is worthy of dialogue.
I have to agree. I think we're in for a dark period. We're out of time. We were joined from Tehran by Mohammad Mirandi. He's an expert on American studies and post-colonial literature, and he teaches at the University of Tehran. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
President Trump yesterday disinvited the entire Philadelphia Eagles football team from a White House event celebrating their Super Bowl victory because a handful of players were not planning to attend. The president was offended that individual players were boycotting the event, and he released a statement criticizing them and alluding to the controversy over kneeling during the national anthem. We're joined from Philadelphia by racial justice activist Candace McKinley. Candace, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Candace, this is kind of an odd little kerfuffle that came up yesterday because the president tweeted a lot last night about NFL players kneeling during the national anthem. He alluded to the notion that the Philadelphia Eagles were kneeling during the national anthem. That's just simply not true. None of them kneeled during the national anthem for the entire season. Now, Fox News yesterday ran a photo of the entire team kneeling, and it turned out that the picture was of them praying before a game, not kneeling during the anthem, and Fox had to apologize. Why do you think Donald Trump would invent this situation here? Why not just not say anything?
Well, I think it's in line with Trump's behavior that we've seen since even before his election, and that he gives off the appearance of idiocy, and I think he is a little stupid, but he has a purpose in the lies that he tells and the obvious glaring, just like omissions of fact that he tells his followers. And he's speaking to a certain population who, like anything that he says, they take as truth and law, even if it's easily discovered that what he's saying is not true. And I think it's just another form that he uses of distraction and getting people to focus on things that don't matter rather than the things that he is doing that do matter to a lot of people. So, I just think it's part of his distraction game and speaking to his base for whom facts really don't matter.
I want to read the president's statement and then a response from Torrey Smith, one of the Philadelphia Eagles. The president said, "The Philadelphia Eagles are unable to come to the White House with their full team to be celebrated tomorrow. They disagree with their president because he insists that they proudly stand for the national anthem, hand on heart, in honor of the great men and women of our military and the people of our country. The Eagles wanted to send a smaller delegation, but the 1,000 fans planning to attend the event deserve better. These fans are still invited to the White House to be part of a different type of ceremony, one that will honor our great country, pay tribute to the heroes who fight to protect it, and loudly and proudly play the national anthem. I will be there at 3 o'clock p.m. with the United States Marine Band and the United States Army Chorus to celebrate America." And then Torrey Smith responds, "So many lies, shaking my head. Here are some facts. Number one, not many people were going to go. Number two, no one refused to go simply because Trump insists folks stand for the anthem. Number three, the president continues to spread the false narrative that players are anti-military." Where do you think this goes from here? This isn't because he has any kind of particular hatred of the Philadelphia Eagles. I think that it's bigger than that. And interestingly, from a president, not only who never served in the military, but the last five generations of Trump family members didn't serve in the military.
Right. I mean, I think it's really not about Philadelphia or the fact that players were not going to come despite his invitation, because several teams have done that in the past as well. It's well known that he's unpopular. From his very inauguration, where it was very few people, it's clear that he doesn't have, you know, I guess that pull of other presidents who people want to come and meet him at the White House. So I think in a sense, like, part of his lying is to sort of stay safe, to sort of, like, prevent a really embarrassing situation where there might have been, like, I don't know, five people there or something from the Eagles. I think in his attempt to deflect, I do think it's funny that people do buy into his lies about honoring, respecting the military when it's clear from him and his family's record that they don't care about veterans, they don't care about the military. I mean, his very father, I think it was his great-great-grandfather, I remember reading about how he was petitioning not to be deported, basically because I think he was, like, draft dodging in Germany. He has this family history, like you said, of, like, dodging military service and, like, even going so far as to, like, you know, try to go to other countries to get out of his duties. I don't think it's about the military. And again, he's talking to his base, for whom facts don't matter, who wants to believe, you know, the lie that he's cares about them, he's on their side, he cares about the military and honor, and that really, I think, is just about his ego and saving face. And, like, I also was reading something interesting about some people theorizing that part of his grievance goes back to his failed attempt at forming his own national football league. I think it was called the USFL, and how that failed and how he's been unable to get full ownership or partial ownership of an NFL team of his own. And so, like for many things, he's petty, and he holds grievances. And I think this is, you know, part of that. Like, his whole tirade and campaign against the NFL, I think, is probably linked to that, his pettiness.
Brian, I've said a million times, I'm going to say it again.
A million and one.
That's right. We have to be careful not to underestimate Donald Trump, because we have underestimated him repeatedly, and now he's in the White House. This reminds me very much of the 1988 election, where George H.W. Bush did not want to run against Michael Dukakis on the issues. And so he created the issue of the Pledge of Allegiance. And that became the driving issue of the 1988 election, if you recall. Now, nobody really cares about the Pledge of Allegiance when you really ought to be talking about putting people back to work and reducing inflation, et cetera, et cetera. But it worked, and the Republicans were able to control the debate back then. I wonder if we're seeing the earliest issue of the 2020 election right now with this whole national anthem thing.
Yeah, I think it's a good point. I think Candace is hitting a lot of, like, really important points, but the point that you're making is also a good point, and I want to get Candace's reaction to it. When you're attacking the NFL players who are kneeling, even in this case, the Philadelphia Eagles were not kneeling, basically attacking African-American players. When you're appealing to the wonderful fans, you're appealing demographically mainly to white people, even if the white people in Philadelphia are not necessarily going to be supporters of Donald Trump. Maybe they are, maybe they're not. That's not my point. The point is that Trump is now already beginning a racist campaign for the 2020 campaign, demonizing African-American players. And again, it's this toxic mix. If they all came to the White House and wanted to embrace Donald Trump and say he was a great guy and pose with pictures with him, that would be fine. But because, as Torrey Smith, the player, said, we just actually don't want to go to the White House because we don't want to be around Donald Trump. It has nothing to do with the national anthem. Trump, the narcissist, the egomaniac, but also the racist, wants to take advantage of this to do just as you're saying, John, launch his election campaign basically through a racist dog whistle. Go ahead, Candace.
Well, I would just say that his whole campaign when he first went for president was based on racist dog whistles. So this really isn't new. And I think, like, the one thing is when it comes to black athletes in sports. It's like, it makes me think of like Jesse Owens. His like famous like showing in like the Berlin Olympics and like in front of Hitler and basically smashing the myth of Aryan supremacy. And, you know, he wasn't, you know, a militant in his early life, not until like later in his life did he appreciate, you know, the militant activists of the 1970s. But just by his very presence was sort of like a middle finger to white supremacists. And I think for a large extent, like a lot of the fact that a lot of these sports now are so dominated by African Americans, you know, our very presence, I mean, might be a niggling, you know, type of middle finger to white supremacy, but it's only when people actively, we have to do now more now than be present because there's so many of us, but actually use our platform to say things. So I think like it's an easy distraction and dog whistle because, you know, having players kneel, which is a very, I guess, minor form of protest, you know, in reality, you know, like what is now seen as that middle finger to white supremacy, sort of saying that like, we're not just going to be like docile, not like people that you pay for to play for you to make you happy, but we realize what's happening to black people all over this nation, and we're going to use what platform we do have to say something about it. And people realize that. So they, when they see people kneeling, they know, they really know it's not about the flag. They know it's not about the military. They know that it really is about something about white supremacy and how that works in our country. And that's what is arranging them. So I think you're totally correct that using this issue, focusing people on the protests and kneeling is about, like, talking to his base who are already sort of gripped in the fear of being displaced and being replaced by people and feeling that they're the ones who are actually being marginalized because some things have a whiff of equality now that they're not used to. This is speaking to those people who are being driven by those type of irrational feelings and will go to the ballot box like they did in the last, you know, presidential election and vote for that again.
Those are the important issues, John. Candace McKinley is exactly right. We're out of time, but we're going to keep following this story. I salute the Philadelphia Eagles for just not wanting to be around Donald Trump, because who would?
Well, we were joined from Philadelphia by racial justice activist Candace McKinley. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The Pentagon is increasing spending on a secret research effort to use artificial intelligence to help anticipate the launch of a nuclear-capable missile, as well as to track and target mobile missile launchers. If the effort is successful, such computer programs will be able to think for themselves. We're joined in the studio by Dr. Lawrence Korb. He's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and a senior advisor to the Center for Defense Information. Dr. Korb was formerly Director of National Security Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations in New York, and he was Assistant Secretary of Defense during the Reagan administration. We're very happy to have you here in the studio.
Nice to be with you.
So tell us, this new development into artificial intelligence at the Pentagon, is this a good thing or is it a bad thing?
No, I think it's a good thing. I mean, technology is changing the nature of the way we gather information and the way we fight wars. And it's not just the United States. A lot of other countries are using artificial intelligence, and our budget for artificial intelligence, which includes the program you mentioned, has gone from about $400 million to close to $1 billion right now.
And what exactly does it do? Are we talking about Cray computers making predictions, or is it something different?
No, I mean, basically what it is, I mean, if you look at traditionally, countries have used human intelligence to find out, you know, what their adversaries or potential adversaries are doing. So this is just sort of the latest. The interesting thing is, if you go back and you look, it was stuff that the Pentagon was doing, which led to what we call the internet.
That's
okay,
right.
Okay. But on the other hand, this time, the Pentagon and other government agencies are getting stuff from the private sector, which is very good for this, and using it for national security. And we're not the only ones. I mean, the Chinese are very, very big on using this.
So where does this technology come from? Is it Google, Apple, Microsoft? We know that they're all involved in one way or another in artificial intelligence.
Yeah, it comes from the private sector, and then the Pentagon works with the private sector to develop this capability to provide for our national security. And what's happening is, given the United States' overwhelming conventional power advantage, countries like China, for example, are using this to offset the American advantage. And what's happening in government in the last couple of years is that the United States is basically saying, you know, we need an offset strategy. We've had the first and second offsets where we used our technical capabilities to offset then what was the Soviet conventional advantage, and now others are using it against us. So we have to make sure that we keep up, and in some cases keep ahead.
So can you tell us how far away we are from implementation of something like this? And once it's implemented, what exactly will it look like?
Well, again, you know, basically, we have this capability in a lot of areas. The real question is, will you ensure that basically it works and it doesn't lead you to a false conclusion? I mean, we know that a lot of times during the Cold War, both the United States and then the Soviet Union basically had what we call false positives, saying that, you know, the other side was launching nuclear weapons. Fortunately, we had human beings who said, you know, let's make sure, it just doesn't make sense. And I think what you want to do now with the artificial intelligence is, somebody says, well, wait a second, you know, somebody's attacking American ships in the Pacific, you know, or on their way, to make sure that that has happened and people are not creating a false positive. Because we know that this can be done with artificial intelligence. It's done an awful lot in the private sector. I mean, we've had a group of, you know, kids at MIT be able to offset or, you know, take the information they got or present false information.
So there's going to be a level of human oversight to this thing.
Well, there has to be. And I think that's the key thing. If we ever give that up, I think then we put our future based on machines which can make mistakes, which can be, corrupted or undermined. So I think that's really the key thing. I mean, you see it all the time. You know, people do it to create things on the stock market, you know, to make money. So I think you do need to have the human oversight to make sure, well, wait a second, does that make sense? Make sure it's right. And because if you don't, you can't turn it back.
We're speaking with Dr. Lawrence Korb. Dr. Korb is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, a senior advisor at the Center for Defense Information, CDI. He was formerly director of national security studies at the Council on Foreign Relations in New York. And in the 1980s, he was assistant secretary of defense during the Reagan administration. Dr. Korb, 30 years ago, we watched science fiction movies about future wars, and the soldiers were robots. Are the soldiers going to be robots?
Well, there's no doubt about the fact that robotics or robots are taking an increasing role both in the private sector and in military. And again, I think this is something that you need to understand. You need to ensure that it does protect your security and doesn't do things that a human being might say, wait a second, that information you fed me is wrong, so therefore I'm not going to do this or that. Whereas a robot, it's too late.
Yes, there's a number of factors that I'd like to just quickly explore because we have a limited amount of time. There's the, as you mentioned, during the Cold War, where human beings intervened and said, wait a second, we don't actually think there's an incoming nuclear weapon, where the protocol was for them to fire back, but they didn't do that. And as a consequence, we didn't annihilate the species. Thank goodness for those human beings, those individuals. So that's one element. There's another element, too, that I think is also important that should be explored or discussed a little bit, which is that politicians are the ones who direct wars, who order military operations. And politicians are answering to different lobbies, maybe their own political calculations. But one of the key factors in at least previous wars, maybe this is becoming less so today with drone warfare, is that human beings were involved in fighting and dying and bleeding. Human beings mattered. What human beings and what their families and what society thought about these interventions mattered. And as a consequence, they had to be factored into these important calculations about war and peace. with the diminution of human loss in war, if machines, or at least on some sides, like the American side, if it's drone warfare, if it's robotics, if we don't feel the pain of war, it makes it easier in some ways for politicians to order war, to go to war. What's your take on that?
Well, there's no doubt about the fact that obviously, particularly in a democratic society where people have a say about, you know, going to war, that the potential human cost is always factored in, and you want to see if the cost is worth the gain that you're trying to do. But if you go back and you look historically, when we got the airplane, a lot of people thought, well, that's going to eliminate no more ground wars, you know, that we'll be able to, you know, have a man or woman up there flying, and he or she can drop bombs, and we can achieve our objectives with very little loss of human life. But particularly when you're talking about conflicts that don't pose an existential threat to the society. If it's an existential threat, then you obviously
Willing to sacrifice.
Willing to sacrifice. But if you have what, you know, we call war of choice as opposed to war of necessity, then I think the human factor does come in, and it's a good thing. I mean, because every life is, I think, very, very important. And I think it's interesting, too, that a lot of countries try and cover up the number of losses. You know, for example, you know, what the Russian government was putting out about how many died in Syria was not what the mothers and fathers of those kids back home were saying. Wait a second, there's, you know, you haven't told us about this or who was, you know, that. So I do think it's important, particularly when you're dealing with wars of choice. And fortunately, these days, given the distribution of power in the international system, it's no longer against fascism or communism. It's basically these wars of choice to try and ensure that you have what Samantha Power, a former ambassador to UN, used to call the responsibility to protect.
Yeah. You know, Dwight D. Eisenhower, in that famous final farewell address as he was leaving office in January 1961, warned of the dangers of the military-industrial, he also said, congressional complex, but they took that out because they didn't want to have too much trouble with the Congress people.
Well, he thought he was going to give it in front of Congress. That's why he took
yeah,
it
so
out.
It would have been, otherwise, we know it as a military-industrial congressional complex, which is all true. But now we're also looking at military-industrial technology congressional complex. And the technology is, it's in many ways considered neutral or benign by all of us because we all use it. We use Google or we use Facebook or some other platform. And yet if these companies, these privately owned companies are being integrated into basically a military apparatus, does it pose new dangers for democracy, as Dwight D. Eisenhower argued about 60 years ago?
Paradoxically, it doesn't. In fact, you probably saw that one of our major technology companies, a lot of the workers said, we don't want to be working with the Department of Defense. And the technology in the private sector is outpacing the military. We used to talk about spin-offs as we did for the computers. Right now it's spin-on. We have to go and get the technology from them. But I think what the technology doing is basically two things. One, you want to keep up with your potential adversaries. The other is you want to ensure that you basically minimize the loss of human lives when you're trying to accomplish a particular objective. I mean, if you have a drone trying to find out, you know, what's happening in a particular area, and you can send an unmanned plane to get that intelligence, it's much better than sending a plane manned by a man or woman who could get shot down or crash.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. We're out of time. We were joined here in the studio by Dr. Lawrence Korb. He is the senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and a senior advisor to the Center for Defense Information. He was also formerly director of national security studies at the Council on Foreign Relations in New York, and he was assistant secretary of defense during the Reagan administration. We were very happy to have him here in the studio.
Loud and clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Prosecutors representing special counsel Robert Mueller yesterday accused former Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort of jury tampering. They say that Manafort has attempted to influence the testimony of two witnesses in his upcoming criminal trial, and they're asking a judge to revoke his bail and send him to jail. We're joined from New York by Daniel Lazar. He's a journalist and author of three books, The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. Daniel, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Daniel, first of all, what exactly is Manafort being accused of? What did he allegedly do with these two witnesses?
Well, he's accused of trying to reach out to them to tamper with their testimony, which is not a good thing as far as I know. Although it's interesting to note that one of the intermediaries he allegedly used said in one of his texts that what he was trying to persuade the witness to do was just to tell the truth. So I'm not sure whether that amounts to jury to witness tampering or what.
It's kind of an interesting thing because what Manafort was trying to do was he used WhatsApp app, which, you know, some people think means the government can't read it.
Right.
That all changes once you're indicted, or if the people who are receiving your WhatsApp message actually turn it over to the government, which is what appeared to be in this case. But he's reaching out to two former associates and reminding them, it seems, and these are very short messages, reminding them that the work he was doing in Ukraine with Yanukovych, who's always characterized in the U.S. media as a pro-Russian or a pro-Putin leader in Ukraine, what Manafort was doing, and he was doing it with other lobbyists, including some noteworthy Democratic Party lobbyists in Washington, I believe, and including perhaps the Podesta group, we'll see about that, trying to convince Yanukovych to orient towards the West, not the East, trying to get Yanukovych to orient towards the EU. And in fact, we've heard many times that Russians actually thought Manafort's intervention in Ukraine was to the detriment of Russia because trying to pull Ukraine in the direction of the EU. Anyway, that was what he's apparently reminding people of. It doesn't speak at all to the issue of did he launder money? Did he hide money so he didn't have to pay taxes on it? He's just trying to politically, it seems like, establish like this actually wasn't for Russia. This was for taking Ukraine out of Russia's orbit. Do you read it that way, Daniel?
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I'm hesitant to leap to Manafort's defense, but that's the way it seems at first glance. He was just trying to remind these people what they were actually doing. He was trying to tell the truth, or so one of the intermediaries indicates. But I'm sure more will come out. But listen, I'm very skeptical of the whole Manafort affair because it's just so obviously, blatantly political. And I think clearly the prosecutors are trying to turn the screws in the guy to make him testify about Trump. And that strikes me as very strange and clearly political.
One of the things that confuses me about this whole situation is we know from these documents that the prosecutors filed yesterday accusing him of attempted jury tampering. They just lay the accusation out there, but they don't charge him with attempted jury tampering. They use it only, it seems to me, as leverage to revoke his bail and make him sit in jail through his trial.
Yeah, and all the time before the trial.
Starting today.
Right. Because the judge has ordered, a U.S. District Judge, Amy Berman Jackson, has set a hearing for June 15th where she will consider whether to revoke Manafort's house arrest and jail him while awaiting trial. And then I think she's given him until Friday to respond to allegations that he made several attempts to tamper with witnesses in this ongoing prosecution. So if Manafort goes to jail on June 15th, right, Daniel, what they're doing is talking to Manafort and basically saying, look, Manafort, here's a couple options. You can sit out the rest of the time before the trial and probably for many years, perhaps decades after the trial. We have the goods on you about the tax evasion, money laundering. They probably have all of that because Manafort's obviously was engaged. I mean, not obviously, seems to have been engaged in all of that. So he's going to go to prison unless what? What do they want from Manafort?
They want him to flip.
They want him to flip. And what does it mean then to flip? What does it mean, Daniel?
Well, it means to provide them with information they can use against Trump. But that's, of course, assuming that there was any collusion there, which I think so far I've been completely unimpressed by any of the evidence that's been put forth. So they're trying to get Manafort to testify about something which may not exist. And by the way, you know, bear in mind that the Poroshenko government has backed off from the famous Black Ledger. That was the ledger that which was supposedly detailed $12.7 million in payments to Manafort. The Poroshenko government has a year ago said that the ledger actually showed no such thing. Now, the Poroshenko may have been trying to cozy up to Trump and therefore, you know, backing off from the prosecution. That's certainly possible. But I just wouldn't leap to any conclusions as to what Manafort is guilty or not guilty of, because the prosecution is just so overtly political.
I agree. And I have to say that I've been consistently surprised at the heavy-handedness of the prosecution since Manafort was arrested. In the greater scheme of things, these charges aren't really that big of a deal. I mean, he hasn't committed murder. He hasn't robbed banks. It's a lot of this is paperwork.
Well, they're saying Manafort, they're saying he did steal tens of millions of dollars.
Well, he failed to pay taxes on the tens of millions of dollars and then laundered it.
He laundered it, yeah. Right. So in other words, instead of paying the money, they're alleging that he hid the money,
right,
by saying making real estate purchases in the United States.
Correct.
And then eventually you can sell the real estate, and so you've laundered the money that was gotten in and for you, lobbying on behalf of the Yanukovych government in Ukraine. You hide the money. You don't have to pay taxes on it. They're right. Also accusing him of failing to register as a foreign agent for Yanukovych. That's another one of the charges.
Yeah, and like I say, that's a paperwork charge.
It's even less than a paperwork charge. It's really a BS charge. I mean, 9/10 of the foreign agents in Washington are unregistered. So it really is a failure to fill out a certain form. But you know, as I said, just my ears prick up because this whole thing just leaks of politics.
That leads to this heavy-handedness accusation that I'm making for crimes that are, you know, white collar crimes and not on the most extreme end of seriousness among white collar crimes. The heavy-handedness of the prosecution is surprising to me, that they want this guy to sit in jail through trial, which could be, you know, forever from now. God knows how these things are delayed time and time again. And then in which case he may not even get credit if he's convicted and sentenced. He may not get credit for the time that he spends in jail pre-trial. I mean, oftentimes the prisoner doesn't get credit. I have to agree with Daniel. This seems so political. The point is to break him and to force him to flip and testify against Donald Trump.
And say something. In other
something,
words,
anything.
It doesn't have to be anything necessarily of substance. I mean, Trump posture here, Daniel, is like, fine, we don't care about Paul Manafort because he has nothing to reveal. They're not going out of their way, at least, to suggest, and you know, Trump is on a pardon sort of path at the moment, pardoning a lot of people. He should be pardoning you, John Kiriakou, but he's not. He doesn't seem to be in the mood to pardon Paul Manafort, and it, in fact, says, "Go ahead, we don't care." Paul Manafort has nothing to reveal about us. Now, interestingly, Paul Manafort, just for our audience, has been a longstanding Republican Party operative.
Oh, for decades, many decades.
And he was brought in March of 2016 into the Trump campaign to help kind of normalize it when Trump was hunting for Republican delegates because he had a lot of influence amongst Republicans. And then Trump fired him in August again once it came out that he had all of these business dealings with Ukraine, with Yanukovych. 1 minute left, Daniel. Go ahead.
Well, I just think we have to be very cautious. I don't want to lead to conclusions, but Mueller's under incredible pressure. These proceedings have been thoroughly politicized, and I think I think skepticism is the order of the day. I mean, Manafort's a bad guy. He represented a lot of really bad people. So maybe the money laundering charges are true. I don't know. But none of this has anything to do with collusion. And I think that Mueller is pretty obviously, Ryan says, trying to break the guy and somehow force him to testify against Trump. even though I agree with that there really is no there there. I just don't believe there was any significant collusion at all.
Yeah, and you have the, I'm looking at the Washington Post right now. It goes right along with what Daniel's saying. The Washington Post, of course, is just, no matter what, they're trying to, and on, no matter on what basis, trying to use the probe to bring down Trump. Again, we're, none of us are Trump supporters here. But the headline right now, as I'm looking at it, today's The Fix, Paul Manafort could now be in even more trouble. That should worry Trump, headline. Okay, that's kind of just, that's kind of a form of thuggery. Anyway, John, I think we're out of time.
We're out of time. We were joined from New York by Daniel Lazar. Daniel is a journalist and the author of The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The Supreme Court, by a 7-2 vote, ruled yesterday that a Colorado cake shop owner did not have to make a wedding cake for a same-sex couple. The ruling was narrowly written and specific only to this case, but experts believe that it will encourage other people to file anti-civil rights cases based on religious freedom arguments. We're joined in the studio by Jeremy Davis. He's the executive director of Pride at Work, the LGBT constituency group of organized labor. Welcome, Jeremy.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Jeremy, the commentary in the news coming out of this decision is that it was very narrowly written, as if that's supposed to placate people. But I think these experts are onto something when they say that it also may encourage other people who have biases of one sort or another to file cases based on religious freedom arguments. For example, Brian and I were joking just before this segment started that what's to keep somebody working in a supermarket from refusing to sell you a ham because they're Muslim, or alcohol because they're Mormon, et cetera, et cetera? How do we get around something like that?
Well, you know, that is absolutely the danger of these religious freedom, or as we call them, religious exemptions type arguments, because that's exactly what they want, is they want exempted from the law because of their religious belief. And that's not the kind of society that we live in. We live in a society where we have multiple religions and multiple beliefs, and everybody has to get along. And if we start putting one religion above other religions, then we're just going to have a cascade of problems from there, including this kind of discrimination. Like you said, you know, what if somebody doesn't want to sell you a ham? What if the pharmacist doesn't want to give you birth control? What if the cashier doesn't want to ring up your alcohol, et cetera? Go on, go on, go on. Like, this is a serious problem that has to be addressed and can't be addressed in the way that it's being addressed now. I mean, we're fortunate that this Supreme Court case was decided so narrowly. But unfortunately, the Supreme Court did kind of punt on the question
right back
of
to the circuit courts.
Right. And so, you know, we don't have a clear answer on how included LGBTQ people are in civil rights laws.
I know you'll remember this case, John. Newman versus Piggy Park Enterprises. That's the 1964 decision where the Piggy Park Enterprises, a drive-in barbecue chain with four restaurants created and operated by Maurice Bessinger, the Baptist head of the National Association for the Preservation of White People, made the argument that he and his chain of restaurants did not have to serve black people for religious purposes. And he went to court because the 1964 Civil Rights Act said that that's no longer legal. Apartheid was ending, at least formally legally ending. This went all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court finally ruled, I believe in 1968, that's saying, no, you can't use religious grounds for the basis for discrimination to violate the rights of black people in America. Now, the Supreme Court, by narrowly deciding this case, has not overturned the Newman versus Piggy Park Enterprises case. That's what gives this some hope. And we know that there's been many, many, many other reactionary court rulings against LGBTQ people, against marriage equality in the past. But because the community kept fighting, organizing, mobilizing, ultimately the courts reflect, even these reactionary courts, reflect the changed political climate. That's the task at hand, right?
Absolutely. It's changing the climate. You know, we we still live in a country where there is no national law that specifically protects LGBTQ people from discrimination. And, you know, there's a patchwork of state laws. Only about, 24 states, 23 states protect LGBTQ people in the workplace, public accommodations, et cetera. So the majority of LGBTQ people in the majority of the country actually lives in an area where LGBTQ people are not specifically protected by law.
Yeah, and that's the thing about the Civil Rights Act. A protected class of people means that those rights cannot be messed with because of local jurisdictions or somebody's religious beliefs or whatever, a protected class of people. The LGBTQ community or individuals are not a protected class of people, even though we know that there is systematic bigotry, discrimination that's gone on for a long, long time, and it will continue to go on for a long, long time unless it's illegal. So let's just talk and help the audience understand why this was narrowly drawn, because it appears that the baker who refused to write on top of the cake something about the marriage of these two gay men, what the court said was the commission that made the ruling in Colorado did not give him a fair hearing. In other words, it's about the process rather than the merits of this case, right?
Right. In a way, said that the commission, some of the commissioners were too mean. They actually, there were parts of the record where they denigrated the gentleman's religion. There was a comparison to the Nazis that was written in the, and I believe also that religion had been used to justify slavery. And so with those things actually in the record of the commission's report, that's what the Supreme Court seized upon so that they wouldn't have to answer that broader question of whether or not LGBTQ people are a protected class. And instead just decided this based on the facts of this case alone.
Jeremy, why was this vote not close? Why was this not a sort of a traditional 5-4 conservative over liberal vote? It was 7-2.
Yeah, you know, there's been some speculation about that, and obviously we can't know what was in various justices' minds. But one of the beliefs is that they had to cobble together a majority to find some common ground because, I mean, there were, what, four opinions written in this case?
Right, four separate opinions.
Yeah. And so part of the thinking is that the only way they could come to a majority was to decide on these narrow grounds. And there's also a belief that at least with Justice Kagan, that she joined the opinion to make sure that it was narrow and wasn't precedent setting.
So what do you think we should expect in coming civil rights cases like this?
I definitely see more cases coming based on these religious grounds. Absolutely. I think you were right about that. I think that ultimately the cases are going to be found in favor of the LGBTQ community. We're starting to see that, you know, despite the fact that there's not a national law that specifically says that LGBTQ people are protected, there's starting to be this interpretation of existing sex protections. So they're saying that because you're discriminating against a gay person, for example, that is in its basis a sex discrimination case because it's the sex of the individual that you disagree with who they love. So it's wrapped up in sex discrimination. So the courts are starting to see that. The same thing for transgender people. There's a lot more case law, in fact, that says that transgender discrimination is sex discrimination under the Civil Rights Act of 1964.
So you believe that positive change is going to come from the judiciary rather than from the legislative branch?
You know, the way things are going, it's possible that the judiciary could get to this answer first. You know, there is a bill in Congress called the Equality Act that would take care of a lot of these issues. It would guarantee equality in public accommodations, which is what this case is about, employment, housing, education, jury service, credit, et cetera, that would really kind of answer these questions nationwide instead of, you know, well, which state am I in? How much protection do I have? I don't know for sure. And it would just solve all of those problems.
Yeah, there's going to be more cases for sure because the court left this open. The court wasn't the reactionaries on the court who probably would have wanted to, you know, to undermine and sort of eviscerate basic rights for, well, it's not just for the LGBTQ community. It's about eviscerating marriage equality rights as well, which
right.
of course are core to that community.
That's right.
And the Supreme Court ruled that marriage equality must be understood and embraced, and it's the law of the land. And yet the same thing was true about abortion rights. But then you had the right wing going after abortion rights, whittling away abortion rights, so much so that for big parts of the country, or women in big parts of the country, abortion rights don't actually exist for all practical purposes. You're with Pride at Work. I mean, that's the LGBTQ movement inside the labor movement. It's so important that the labor movement, finally, the labor movement, the unions in America came to embrace the movement of people for equality. Will the labor movement take this up?
You know, the labor movement has already taken up a lot of this. You know, the predecessor to the Equality Act was the Employment Non-Discrimination Act. It focused just on the employment discrimination piece. And at least half of the major international unions endorsed that piece of legislation. And, you know, we're still doing our rounds of endorsements for the Equality Act, but the AFL-CIO is on board and several of the large unions are on board. So, you know, I feel very confident. You know, there's also a big push for more inclusion of LGBT protective language in contracts as well. You know, there have been several unions. One that comes to mind is Unite Here. The president, D. Taylor of Unite Here, actually specifically called out his local presidents and said, we need to get this into the contracts.
That's extremely important. In addition to the law of the land, to get this into collective bargaining agreements for workers, extremely important. John, I think we're out of time.
We are. We were joined here in the studio by Jeremy Davis. He's the executive director of Pride at Work, the LGBT constituency group of organized labor. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We're completely out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and you want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us now on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes and at iHeartRadio. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.